From Seminary Co-op Bookstores in Chicago, this is OpenStax. I'm Colin McDonald.
The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. In 1797, Samuel Taylor Coleridge began work on The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, a poem whose strange tale of a wayward ship's salvation by an albatross, the pointless and taboo murder of that bird by a mariner, and the terrible events that ensued has been read, among other ways, as a religious allegory, the spiritual autobiography of the poem's author, and a metaphor for technology's role in the haphazard destruction of the natural world. In this final interpretation, the mariner's choice of weapon, a crossbow, has been singled out as a symbol for technology's relationship to war and the carelessness of its application. Famously, in penance for his deed, the crew forced the mariner to wear the albatross around his neck. Without comparing technology to a dead bird forced upon us by society, we may find ourselves out to sea asking how, as devices become more ubiquitous in our jobs and relationships, we might navigate their use. With this question in mind, we're joined this week by historians Marie Hicks and Tom Mullaney, who investigate the hidden and explicit preferences and prejudices that are not only parts of systems of governance and innovation, but also integrated into the designs and functions of everyday objects. First, we'll hear Marie Hicks, who tells the history of women codebreakers during World War II and their central role in early computing in the United Kingdom, where sexism in the field eventually led to the implosion of the British computer industry. Then Tom Mullaney helps us chart the mainstream development of typewriters, which expanded to include more and more languages, with the notable exception of Chinese. Against that backdrop, the history of the Chinese typewriter demonstrates how power through language insinuates itself into the smallest quotidian action, such as the journey of a finger between keystrokes, and dictates massive networks like international telecommunication systems. Stay with us. Marie Hicks is a historian of technology, gender, and modern Europe. Their new book is Programmed Inequality: How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. Hicks teaches courses on modern European history, the history of technology, gender and sexuality studies, and disasters at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Speaking of disasters, Hicks once inflated a 13-foot Stay Puft Marshmallow Man Halloween decoration in their apartment with predictably destructive and hilarious results. You can see for yourself at mariehicks.net.
In 1959, a computer operator embarked on an extremely hectic year, tasked with programming and testing several of the new electronic computers on which the British government was becoming increasingly reliant. In addition, this operator had to train two new hires with no computing experience for a critical long-term project in the government's central computing installation. After being trained, the new hires quickly stepped into management roles, while their trainer, who was described as having a good brain and a special flair for computer work, was demoted to an assistantship below them. This situation seems to make little sense until you learn that the trainer was a woman and the newly hired trainees were men. Yet, this is not simply an example of unfair labor practices. It's part of a larger story about attempts to shape the newly developing digital economy. This woman's tale is emblematic of broader changes. In the 1940s, computer operation and programming was viewed as women's work, but by the 1960s, as computing gained prominence and influence, men displaced the thousands of women who had been pioneers in a feminized field of endeavor, and the field acquired a distinctly masculine image. How and why this change happened holds important lessons for contemporary economies and high-tech labor markets, yet the change is still poorly understood. When the gender makeup of a field flips, the first assumption is usually that the content of the work within the field changed. When a field feminizes, people often assume that the work became simpler. When a field becomes male-dominated, the assumption is the reverse, that the work became more difficult or complex. Yet as one can see from this example, that was not the case in early computing. A second related assumption might be called the technological switch. This is the idea that a major technological change inexorably alters the labor composition of a field. Usually, more machinery and automation lead to feminization, a familiar historical pattern seen in everything from textile manufacture to typewriting. Yet the changeover from electromechanical to electronic computers did not result in further feminization, nor did it coincide neatly with computing's masculinization. A final assumption about gendered labor change is that when women disappear from a field, a lack of interest, a lack of relevant skills, or an inability to get hired plays a major role. This, again, does not account for why women lost out in computing. Like the operator in the earlier example, many women were present in the field, interested in the work, and even had opportunities to prove their proficiency.
Take us back to, you know, the beginning of computing in Britain, or at least where your book starts.
Well, The Imitation Game is really interesting, right? Because they cut electronic computing out of the story completely. It's just about Alan Turing and his electromechanical machines, the bombs, and they just kind of cut the electronic computers out of Bletchley Park's history completely, which is weird because that was a really big deal. It was the reason, for instance, that the D-Day landing succeeded. The information that these electronic code-breaking computers were able to provide almost in real time, well, not in real time, but quickly enough that it was actionable, so that the way that this information was used during the D-Day landings was the Allied forces leaked intentionally false information, saying that their armies were going to be somewhere else. And then they listened for German messages, which they were able to decode with these fast electronic computers, showing that the Germans had taken the bait. And once they had decrypted those messages, saying, okay, the German armies are, they're taking the bait, they're moving, that's when they knew when and where to land.
So wait, there was Alan Turing and his really, like, nice-looking counterparts, but there was this whole other section of electric D encryptors? That were, I mean, how many of these were there? How many people were working on them? How many women were working on them?
Yeah, great question. So first it was hundreds, and then by the end of the war, it would have been thousands of people, primarily women, who were doing all sorts of things at Bletchley Park and who were intercepting all the information and doing all the machine code breaking. Mm-hmm. And the way that Alan Turing fits into this is that he was really important early on in the war, and he did a lot of hand code breaking, and he helped reverse engineer the Enigma machine so that he could create this slower electromechanical computer called the bomb that could kind of step through the possible code settings faster than people could do it, but it was still very slow. And then Turing goes on to do a lot of interesting stuff with electronics after the war, but during the war he's really not involved in electronics. What happens sort of next is that, just like Alan Turing was trying to come up with theoretical, you know, ways to break these codes, there was another code breaker named Bill Tutt, and he had come up with this method called the statistical method, which was essentially a way of brute forcing code breaking. But the thing is, if you deployed this sound method, it was theoretically sound, using people, it would have taken thousands of years to decrypt a single message. It was something that was essentially worthless, until electronic computers become something that is entering the frame as a possibility. So a man named Tommy Flowers, who is a research engineer at the British Post Office, he builds this machine called the Colossus, which was an all-electronic computer. It was the first digital electronic programmable computer in the world. And he actually kind of takes everybody by surprise with this machine. A lot of it is really down to his own perseverance to get this project done. Everybody else sort of thinks it isn't going to work. For instance, 1,600 vacuum tubes at least. So there are thousands of vacuum tubes in these Colossus machines, of which there are 10 in all by war's end.
Wow, how big is this machine?
Room size. So it probably would take up as much room as where all the folks here are sitting today. And if you go to the UK, you can see a working model of it, actually, because the originals were destroyed, but they rebuilt one. But anyway, the idea behind these all of these vacuum tubes, of course, it makes the machine faster, but then it also makes it much more fragile. And so they do a variety of things to try to make the machine less fragile, which most people thought wouldn't work. Tommy Flowers says it will. He ends up being right. And that makes Tut's statistical method now something that can be used very effectively instead of something that, you know, was impossible.
So they built the Colossus, they built machines like it. And how many people had to run them, specifically women? I mean, how many people were doing that work? And was it like, you know, with Grace Hopper, I know they did things, you know, 24 hours a day in shifts. Was it the same thing with women? And then after you tell me this, then after the war, tell me how that jumped into, they break down the Colossus, no one's supposed to talk about it, and then all of these women go into computing otherwise. But tell me how many women worked on this, and then kind of the progression into after the war, what happens to computing in Britain, because they've just made these huge leaps and bounds in innovation for electric computing.
Yeah, so there would be roughly a dozen operators on a shift, and they would all have different jobs. Some would be responsible for setting machines, some would be responsible for handling input or output, some would be responsible, and this is one of the most important jobs, for scheduling how the work was going to be organized, in what order it was going to be run on the machine to maximize the available computing power. And they worked in pretty lousy conditions. These machines, as you know, we mentioned, were really big, they were really hot, they were really noisy, and they were stuffed into essentially tiny little huts that had been hidden on the grounds of Bletchley Park, which was this big country manor. The women had to work shifts. They only got one weekend off a month to go off and, you know, take some R&R. And for a long while, even though they were doing very skilled work, the structure of Bletchley Park, because everything had to be so highly secret, essentially nobody else in the park knew what somebody in a different part of the park was doing. So the women who were actually supervising these women who were working on the computers, they didn't realize the nature of their work. They thought maybe it was something more physical, and so they were having them up at like 6 a.m. doing really strenuous physical drills all, you know, for a couple of hours before they went and worked a full work day. So then eventually somebody who it was in charge of, a man named Max Newman, who was in charge of the machine code breaking section, basically tells the women supervisors, you know, knock it off, they don't have to actually do these drills.
Everybody's out in the world and all of these women have these skills. Take us through these particular women that worked there, but also just the whole landscape of Britain at the time. Like, what's happening? What are women doing for work? What are they coming into? You know, I know there's this whole, women did a lot of office work and computing was seen as that. Kind of set that up so we can talk about labor in that way.
Sure. It's interesting and sad what happens to the world's first electronic computers and their operators, because there's basically this discontinuity because of the extreme secrecy of the projects and the extreme paranoia of Britain. I mean, it's kind of understandable given the devastation of World War II. British government is extremely paranoid about any of this becoming public. So in fact, they keep the Colossus computer secret until the mid-1970s, and they would have kept them secret even longer if information had not started to leak out. When people talked about class in the 1960s, many people did not think about gender at all. A lot of women labor rights.
Did they think about race?
Oh, not even less.
All right.
So a lot of feminist labor rights activists were thinking about gender, but they weren't really in the mainstream conversation much as they were trying to be. And so basically what happens is, with no attention to the people's gender, the gender of the people who are actually doing these jobs, who actually have the skill.
Which at the time was a majority women.
Was majority women.
Okay.
Folks start getting hired for computing jobs on the basis of older ideas about, well, who's a good bet for this job? If we're looking for somebody who's going to have, you know, a long career and who's going to be worth it to invest training in, like, who can we get into these jobs? Now, that doesn't explicitly say no women, but you can start to see how that kind of, that's sort of saying, well, we're going to focus on young men for these kind of new important jobs. And the reason that Kathy gets into the field is actually because she gets in at this point in the mid-1960s where there's a terrible labor shortage and the government is scrambling to basically hire anyone. And so they say, okay, forget it. Women or men, we'll train them all, we'll train them both. We just need more people to be doing these jobs. Well, when the labor shortages ease a bit, then they start, the hiring managers revert to older ideas about how to hire people who they think are going to be reliable.
All right, and why weren't women seen as reliable if they were the smart people doing the punch cards?
Yeah. At the same time that all this is going on, computer work has kind of seen this huge spike in prestige. So it's no longer seen as this rote technical work that just anybody can do, you know, because of all the class issues in Britain, you know, working with machines, even working with a machine in an office is seen as sort of, it's seen as dirty and lower class. And so that's one of the reasons.
So it's still seen like factory work.
Exactly,
okay.
Like the industrialization in the office.
Okay.
So we'll put women on that work, and it's not so important anyway, and it's kind of rote and technical. Technical is seen as something that's, you know, it doesn't have a positive connotation back in this period in time. But as the folks at the top of government and industry start to realize that these jobs are actually important because the people who hold them actually have power, then comes this shift to try to get men into the jobs. So they get seen as incompetent simply because the idea is that they shouldn't wield power. It's not so much that they're not competent, it's the fear that maybe they would be competent and they would then end up rising to like levels of power and influence that they don't deserve. Having a woman in charge of men in this period of time was so problematic that people would get fired over it. Whole departments would be rearranged just to make sure that one woman wasn't supervising like three men. I mean, this seems bizarre, maybe, to modern ears, but the hierarchies of class and the hierarchies of gender that intersected meant essentially that women were not supposed to wield power. And so once computers become these really important tools for wielding power, you can kind of infer what's gonna happen.
Talk to me about, you know, this flip of like this is feminized work to professionalization, right? Because she and I have had a lot of discussions about this. She advised my film, but about professionalization and why that shifted things, and specifically in Britain.
So professionalization is an issue because when, you know, women are doing the work, it's seen as sort of liminally white collar, you know, it's pink collar, which is somewhere between blue collar and white collar. And then as this understanding of computer work is more important starts to be the way the field is seen, there's a huge push to get people from firmly white-collar echelons of the economy into these jobs. And I think one of the reasons this is so important is because it's very counterintuitive what happens. What happens is it means that people who don't have computing skills, like they just do not have the skills, get slotted into jobs because essentially of their class status and their gender, so the opposite of meritocracy, they get slotted into these jobs and they get given a lot of training to do them. And it doesn't work in a lot of cases because a lot of these folks don't even want to be in these jobs. Computing is still seen as kind of a backwater. It's seen as something that really, you know, people would rather do better work. And so a lot of the men who are given these opportunities, which you would think maybe are good opportunities, they don't so much see it that way. And so they take the training, you know, and then a year later they're back in some other administrative position.
If you look at this arc, we're into what, the late 60s. You look at this arc, but where's that downfall? Where do you see this really like being a terrible thing? I'm trying to, you know, we all know this story of, you know, women don't make as much as men. You know, women have been systematically discriminated against, and it's always about the oppressed and not what happens, you know, to industry because this is happening. But you make a really good case in your book for this. So I would love to hear about why that kind of stymied the industry and not just the women.
Sure. So we've talked about how women are kind of getting pushed out of the field, right?
Right.
And then they're trying to get other people into those jobs who aren't necessarily so keen.
Right.
So we have the labor that's doing those jobs being tossed aside. We have new folks who are supposed to come do those jobs not actually coming in to do those jobs. The number one problem with making computers work in this era, and I would say to a certain extent still, is you need to have people who know how to run them. You need to have people who know how to program them and to deploy them in the ways that make them effective for solving the problems of government and industry. And all of a sudden, the folks who are in a position to hire for these jobs, in particular the British civil service, the British government, because, you know, the British government is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, early computer user, instead of training more people, instead of getting more computer labor out there into the country, they are in fact creating a devastating labor shortage. And so what they do next is kind of interesting. They say, well, if we don't have the workers to run these machines, then we just have to make the machines, the computing installations, bigger, more and more centralized, so they can be run by fewer and fewer workers. And so they tell basically the biggest British computing company on the scene, look, we are going to favor you with all of our government contracts and everything if you make us the kind of computers that we want. And essentially, we want these behemoth mainframes, right, where we can just centralize things as much as possible and not have to worry about the fact that we only have like four computer programmers or whatever. And they are asking for this particular technology at a point in time when the mainframe is on its way out. And there is a very good reason for that, because smaller, more agile, decentralized systems are becoming the things that business and industry are realizing are more useful for them. So the company, it's called ICL, they go ahead, they take the government money and input, and they make what the government wants. And by the time it's done, the government says, yeah, no, we made a mistake. We don't actually want that, and sorry, too bad for you, nobody else wants it either. There goes about 30 years of really good, innovative work in computing in Great Britain, just basically down the drain. Because that moment is essentially the moment at which you start to see just the implosion of the British computing industry. And so you can see how we're tracing the fact that they push women out of computing, the fact that they don't have the labor to run these machines, onto what they decide to do in terms of asking for, you know, particular technological design, and then how that has these macroeconomic effects that destroy the British computer industry and actually have really bad effects on Britain's economy as a whole, because computing was supposed to be a really important way that they were going to regain some of their global prestige and also help their balance of trade and, you know, export tools to other nations.
When we first started this, you talked about how the U.S. kind of follows Britain in these things. You know, I know from my studies that women stopped working in computing and getting computing degrees about 10 years after this all goes down in the 70s for Britain, right? So, kind of, tell me, is it a different problem? Is it mirroring Britain? You know, what are things that we can learn from this in our own computing? You know, we're trying to get more women in the pipeline, et cetera, et cetera. So,
one of the things that's helped us all along the way, I mean, obviously there's been enormous discrimination in US history against women, against black people, against many different groups who we're now sort of writing back into the history of computing, like Margot Shetterly's Hidden Figures comes to mind, right? And how she looks at, you know, how instrumental, how important these women were to getting a man on the moon, right? But their labor was basically swept under the rug. One of the things that insulated the United States is that we're just bigger. We have a far bigger labor force, you know? We have, in a certain sense, more leeway to make mistakes for a time. But at a certain point, we're going to see all of the terrible kind of mistakes that we've made in technology result in, I don't know, like the shape of our government changing in ways that is horrifying. I'm not going to say that, you know, that there's one cause for that, right? But you can kind of see how the ways in which we've disregarded all of the biases built into our technologies, that's having a material negative effect on our fortunes as a country.
In her book, there are all of these pictures of advertisements. And in the, like, in the earlier days, these advertisements for computers show, you know, like, these very plain women, women without faces, doing, like, nothing in particular at a machine. And then as it goes on, you know, you see these, like, it becomes sexier and sexier, right? And, like, I understand that it was all about labor, in Britain, but also there seems to be a big change in the way that women are perceived, kind of as they're perceived as almost like non-existent and not there in the beginning, and then they become this symbol of what?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because I think it's really interesting because part of it is about, okay, changing culture and sex appeal just becomes a bigger thing in advertisements.
Right.
But part of it is about centering the woman in the ad more and more because even though the jobs are sort of changing in real life to, you know, require men to do them now, that's the idea, computer companies don't want to show that image to hiring managers, or rather they don't want to show that image to folks who will be in charge of making purchasing decisions and buying machines, because if you show a really expensive machine with a really expensive labor force, you know, men, well, that's not going to be good for your product, right?
Huh.
So they actually use women in sort of a more, you know, like they make the women's figures more personable in later ads so that people who are thinking about buying these enormously expensive computers can feel reassured they're not going to have to spend much on labor and that the computers are going to be easy to run. So it's a way of trying to like kind of make the machines less intimidating, even though it doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of who's going to use them.
Right, because women still made much less than men at that time. Okay, that makes sense.
So, who are these women in the wartime period who are working in computing in terms of class and backgrounds and education specifically?
They're middle or upper class. They're white. They're people who have enlisted in the Women's Royal Naval Services, but in order to get a placement at certain places, in order to get into Bletchley Park as a worker, you had to have social recommendations. So you can sort of see that this is, you know, it's not meritocratic. It's not like anybody who enlists is going there. These were women who were sort of seen as the cream of British society. I'm putting that in air quotes. And they were given these jobs because the idea was that, you know, they deserved them somehow. So even though we're talking about, you know, like women kind of getting the short end of the stick, we have to remember the intersectionality of all of these different identities where some women come out very much on top. One of the sections in the book where I talk about imperialism, essentially, I talk about how the British were trying to use computers just to kind of have a new wave of imperial control over, you know, parts of Africa, over India. It was no longer going to be sort of the direct imperial control, but they were going to now have this sort of backdoor technological imperial control. It's true that you don't see women as prevalently talked about in history books for, you know, kind of theoretical firsts. That doesn't mean that that was the reality. One of the things that happened a lot of the time, as you know, is that people would take credit for other people's work.
Right.
Or somebody would have an idea and then somebody a little bit later would have that same idea. And depending on the identity of the person who had the idea, you know, we know about one and not the other. So I think that that's one way that we've heard things described, explained a lot, but I think that it's a lot less true than we would be sort of led to believe by the histories that we've read.
Tom Mullaney is an associate professor of Chinese history at Stanford University, where he also directs Digital Humanities Asia, a program at Stanford focused on East, South, Southeast, and Inner Central Asia. His new book, The Chinese Typewriter, A History from MIT Press, examines China's development of a modern non-alphabetic information infrastructure encompassing telegraphy, typewriting, word processing, and computing. The book has received 3 major awards and fellowships thus far. Not one to rest on his laurels, however, Mullaney is working on 4 separate book projects on China, technology, death, ethnicity, and colonialism.
I'm going to discuss the kind of making of this book, The Chinese Typewriter, A History, which has been my colleague or my partner for about 9-10 years, and it's a real joy to finally hold it in my hand. In the classes that I teach this course at Stanford University, which is a general introduction to science, technology, society. It's this massive course that's co-taught, and as the resident historian in the group, it's my job and my responsibility to make sure that the students will be able to think historically about technological objects, technological artifacts, history of science, and so forth. I've worked alongside a bioethicist, a sociologist of knowledge, and so one of the things that I begin one of the classes with is a discussion of the keyboard and the laptop, and trying to put forward the question whether or not the laptop itself or the keyboard, the QWERTY keyboard, has a kind of politics embedded within it that we don't often think about. And I walk them through, you know, some other examples that are pretty well known by now. The very famous viral video, HP computers are racist. The other viral kind of meme, racist camera, no, I did not blink, I'm just Asian. This is the blink detection algorithm that was in Nikon. Then going back into the discussion of the Shirley cards, which was the famous color correction material for Kodak film development, the famous Flesh Crayola crayon, accent detection within Siri, the length of time that it takes that is allotted for a person to cross a street. So all of, we try to get them thinking, and generally speaking, in each of the examples that I give them, everyone is ready to follow it. It's sort of second nature. They can understand it, and then I bring them to the keyboard. And I kind of joke that at that point, they kind of say, no, we've got to draw a boundary somewhere. I'm unwilling to believe that this most universal of objects can possibly have the same kind of politics embedded within it. And so then what I'd like to talk about is, you know, stealing bits and pieces from the book, which, although called The Chinese Typewriter, A History, actually deals with the history of Chinese telegraphy, early histories of Chinese computing, the experimental modes of organizing Chinese dictionaries and library card catalogs. It's basically a kind of study of the information architecture for the one major non-alphabetic world script and the crises that beset this information architecture in the basically from the midpoints of the 1800s through to today. It's still going on. And I walk them through, and I'll walk us through, a brief discussion of the telegraph and Morse code, the semiotic architecture of telegraphy, the typewriter, of course, and then with a little bit of discussion of the computer. So in the early parts of the book, I discuss the history of telegraphy. And in particular, I'm not concerned with the infrastructure of telegraphy, the poles and wires and cables, which is when one discusses telegraphy in China and in largely in East Asia and actually many other parts of the world, that's kind of what people focus on. And they ask the question, at what point does this particular non-Western society, country, gain sovereignty over this infrastructure? When do they own the cables and own the stations and so forth? And whenever that date is set to be equal to when they have taken control of their own information architecture, their own system, which is a lie. Because underlying this, the cables, the wires, and so forth, is of course the basic semiotic architecture of telegraphy, which retains its provincial upbringing through its entire existence, including when it's extended to other scripts on Earth. And so Morse code, with its dot and dash, and then typically code units of from 1 to 4 units in length, that's the majority of the code, that is ideal for 30 units, 30 spaces, which is perfect for the 26 letters of the Latin alphabet as used within the English language, with a little room to spare. As this new telecommunications infrastructure began to globalize into the South Asian subcontinent, into the modern Middle East, South Asia, and so forth, it began to encounter languages and writing systems that obviously do not use the Latin alphabet, that have many more than 30 letters, that have, in the case of Chinese, no letters or alphabet at all. And so the question became very quickly, what will this semiotic architecture do? Will there be a radical reimagination of telegraphy so that it can try to achieve something of universality, or will it be extended, will it be stretched in order to encompass these other world scripts? And I think you can probably guess what the answer is. There were some pretty eccentric thinkers who tried to blow up the entire system of Morse code, rebuild it from the ground up, and they used Chinese as their thought experiment to do this, but that's not what happened. What ends up happening is that the kind of compromise is made, and in 1871, the first ever telegraph code is promulgated and officially kind of recognized in the international community for Chinese. In the case of Chinese telegraphy, the only way that you can transmit a Chinese character over wire is by doubly translating it. First, you take the character and translate it into a 4-digit numeric cipher, and then, using Morse code, use standard Morse to transmit those numbers. Chinese will become the only writing system on Earth for which this double translation process needs to take place. And it has immense and immediate effect on the position of the Chinese writing within the global information infrastructure. This is really the beginning of the story that I take up in the book. There's an even more insidious, unintended effect of this compromise, of this extension, which is that when Chinese enters into the international telegraphic community, which is a governed, there's a governing body that oversees it and so forth, it does so under the guise of a code, a secret code, a cipher. So by this point, we're already by 1871 into the fourth decade of electric telegraphy, and people and businesses and governments are very quickly trying to create systems that allow them to transmit messages in compressed, encoded form. One, to make sure that no one can eavesdrop on the transmission, but much more importantly, to save money. And so if we work in an international conglomerate and we share the same code book, we could transmit a message where I send you the word novelty, let's say. And you look up in your code book and you find the word novelty, and it is deliver 300 barrels of beer to Manchester by Sunday next. And that would be the code. Well, the governing body overseeing international telegraphy caught on to that very quickly, and they began to implement laws as early as, 1840s, maybe 1860s, that said, okay, you're allowed to send things in code, but you've got to pay double, or you've got to pay some punitive measure because we're losing money. So what ends up happening is that when Chinese enters the International Telegraphic Union in 1871 with this numeric cipher, the entire logic of the international system says it's a code. It's a secret code. And Chinese becomes the only writing system on Earth for which there is no distinction between plain text or transmitting in the clear and transmitting as a cipher or code. It is, by definition, a code, a secret code. And the Chinese delegates to the International Telegraphic Union, every single time they go to meet in whatever European capital it is, saying, this is not a secret code. It's what the international community gave us. It's not a secret code. It's what we have to work with. And so it basically placed, from the word go, Chinese telegraphy in the context of this global telecommunications revolution, it placed it at both a financial and legal disadvantage, a structurally embedded disadvantage. So then we move into the realm of the typewriting. You know, this is post-Civil War technology that's coming out of precision engineering shops that used to be military arms dealers and manufacturers. That's why the Remington rifle, Remington typewriter, the Smith & Wesson, Smith Corona, these were precision engineering firms that in the post-Civil War era, moving into new areas and begin to make things like typewriters, bicycles, sewing machines, and so forth. But what we often forget is that the early years, the early decades of the typewriter, of the Latin alphabetic English typewriter, was a crazy, weird period of all sorts of strange and bizarre and interesting looking machines. You had machines that looked like this. This is the Hammond multiplex. You had the Mignon typewriters and others that had no keyboard at all. They're called index typewriters. You move the pointer on there along the sort of alphabetic panel, and then as you move the needle over top of the character you want, the corresponding metal slug of that would be brought into the printing position. You had keyboard-based typewriters that had both the upper and lower case on one keyboard, no shift. You also had ones that were operable by one hand. And I put this in front of you because something happened, not in China, but in the United States over the period of the 1860s through basically turn of the century, that in the book I describe as a collapse of technolinguistic imagination, that there was a much wider kind of ecology of imaginings about what a typewriter is and how I interact with it, how do I use my body to interact with it, how it is built, and so forth. There was nothing like the standardization that will set in the 20th century. And this had huge implications not only for this kind of human-machine interaction within the English language, but it had huge implications for the extension of these machines to other languages and writing systems on Earth. Well, what happens? What happens, again, is not taking place in Bangkok or Beijing or Shanghai. It's taking place half a world away. All these different conglomerates are collapsing and crushing. Machines in the English language context are becoming very popular. Some are dying out. And long story short, in the English language context, the single shift Remington-style keyboard wins out. It becomes the machine of choice. Okay, and this machine, this species, this subspecies of typewriting, which we now equate with typewriting, becomes the technolinguistic starting point for the globalization of the typewriter. So one thing that's really important that I try to drive home in the book is this is not the typewriter. This is a typewriter in part of a much larger ecology, but it is the one that becomes the foundation for the globalization of the typewriter. And this has immense implications for all world scripts, but most for the one world script it will never bring into its embrace, which is Chinese character writing. And these companies like Olivetti and Remington and Underwood and Smith Premier, later Smith Corona, they were exceedingly proud of the globalization of these machines. They factor very heavily. You know, our machine is in sub-Saharan Africa. It's in Middle East. Olivetti started typing schools where engineers from around the world would come. It was sort of the Bandung Conference of Typewriting, and they're exceedingly proud of that. We can be found in Indochina. We can be found in the Adirondack. We can be found everywhere. Okay, this is a universal machine, and this is contributing to a sense of a kind of cult of the typewriter. We forget, I mean, it's much, much, much more than a business appliance. It is the main actor in however many dozens of films, from, you know, the lives of others to, you know, we could go down all the list of movies in which the typewriter is actually kind of a leading role. It's sort of a design, you know, object of lust. It's a collector's fantasy. It's used as a musical instrument in Leroy Anderson's The Typewriter. It's part of a, you know, nostalgia campaign. We have famous people who are famous for loving typewriters like Tom Hanks. And, of course, we have the moment in which the typewriter is declared to be holy. And this is not a passing comment that the typewriter is holy. In a certain sense, this is just an astute observation that in some way this thing is sacred. The question then becomes, if the typewriter is sacred, and if the typewriter is universal, and if the typewriter is agnostic, what does that mean about the one writing system that will never be brought into its embrace? That means it's outside of the holy, it's outside of the universal, it's outside of this. So almost exactly in time with the collapse of this broader ecology of alphabetic typewriters and the extension of the single shift keyboard, we see the emergence of a trope that will last and continues to last from 1900 through to the present day. And this is the absurdity, monstrosity, comic ridiculousness of the Chinese typewriter. So this is a cartoon drawn in the year 1900, which shows a Chinese typist running up and down the stairs of this building-sized machine. And when I first looked at this, I've been staring at this image now for 10 years, and for the first 6 years that I looked at it, I thought, oh, this comic is trying to make fun of Chinese. This is a conscious act. And I imagined it particularly through that lens. And it was only after maybe 6 years of that into year seven, I realized, wait a minute, there's no kind of critical distance here. This is not a conscious act of derision. It is an act of derision. But it is an act of derision which emerges out of a kind of stable algorithm that is in the mind by this point. A typewriter is a machine that has keys. There is one key for every unit, subunit of a writing system. Chinese is not alphabetic, so that unit is not a letter. Chinese has characters, so the unit is a character. There are 70,000 of these units, and so therefore there are 70,000 or whatever keys, and we get to this building-sized algorithm. Well, the problem is that, yes, you can't with a mechanical Chinese typewriter if you follow the one-to-one correspondence model of typing. You cannot have one key per character. You can't do it. And the simple fact of the matter is that no Chinese typewriter that ever mass-produced in history ever had a keyboard. This is the first mass-manufactured Chinese typewriter. It doesn't have a keyboard. Now, if we're back in 1873, that's no big deal, because there are lots of typewriters out there that have no keyboard. If we're in 1880, that's actually okay. That's no big deal, 1890. But once you start to get past the 1900 mark, the concept of a typewriter with no keyboard becomes like a Zen koan, like a what's the sound of one hand clapping, even though it need not be. And as this trope of this absurd building-size keyboard-based Chinese typewriter that's absurd, that demonstrates beyond a shadow of a doubt the anti-modernity of the Chinese writing system, it's just beyond the pale, it's outside the universe, it's outside the holy, well, what's going on in China? There is a fully-fledged typewriter industry. There is a world that emerges around this particular machine. It's a tray bed machine. It's an index typewriter like that one I described with the Mignon. It doesn't have a keyboard. Rather, it has this mechanical tray bed of roughly 30 and sometimes 35 by 70 characters on a tray bed. And what you do, quite simply, is with your left hand, you hold on to that knob there, and the tray bed moves left and right. So you can just move it left and right with your left hand. And then with your right hand, you hold on to that knob there, and you can pull that in the X and Y direction. And unlike the Remington or the Underwood, the platen where the paper spool is, right here, that moves. It follows your hand as you move. And so if you want to type a character, which is here, you simply bring it into the type position underneath this chamber, under this one here. And when it's there, you push down on your right hand, a little metal finger pokes up the character from underneath. All of these characters are loose. If you were to take this and turn it over, they'd all fall out. It pokes it up. It gets caught in that metal chamber. In one motion, it rubs up against that white circular thing, which is the ink ribbon, the ink ball. It runs up against it. It strikes the paper. It falls back down and then kind of snaps back into position. And then the inertia of that spits the metal slug back out into the hole that was left behind. It sounds something like this. Tuk-tung. 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 That's the musicality of this particular machine. And so typists would learn the layout of the tray bed, which was divided first into zones of greater and lesser frequency of characters. And as you can tell, there are not 70,000 characters there. The simple compromise that was made to build this machine was, no, we cannot fit 70,000 characters on a machine, or 80,000 characters, however many we want, but we don't need to. What we need to do is to do a rigorous statistical analysis of the frequency of every character in the Chinese language. They determined that roughly 3,000 characters will account for maybe 85 to 90% of all usage. And then if you need some characters that aren't on the machine, that's fine. Remember, these characters are loose. You can remove some, you can add others, you can customize it. It was designed to be manipulable and customizable from the outset. And people played with it. They innovated with it, they experimented with it. It was constantly shifting because it had to constantly shift. So one thing that happened is, by virtue of the fact that you could only ever have maybe 2,500 characters on the machine at any one time, you had to adjust these machines based on where you worked, but it also changed over time. Names of provinces changed, units of measurement changed, and of course, politics changed. And this is my favorite example. In the 1930s, the character for Mao, which simply means a follicle of hair, gets promoted in the 1950s on the new machine. It gets moved from the outer secondary usage section to the very common section. And of course, this isn't because of hair growth in China, it's because of Mao Zedong. So Mao gets promoted, and it's constantly oscillating and changing. Now, something happens that I want to just highlight before moving on to the computer and then the discussion. I briefly mentioned that the tray bed at this point is organized according to the standard dictionary. It's not alphabet because there's no alphabet, but it's, think of it as a highly exoteric, transferable, very rational system of organizing characters that has nothing to do with the way that the words actually unfold in a sentence. In the same way that alphabetic order has apple and aardvark near each other, but of course there's never a sentence in which those two appear. Well, same thing in the context of the Chinese typewriter. So if I want to type Mao Zedong, I have to go to Mao Zedong, Mao Zedong, actually with Mao Zedong, Mao Zedong, and I've got to create this triangle over and over again. And during the Korean War, when I'm constantly typing aid Korea, resist America, aid Korea, or putting American imperialist, or Meidiguo. I'm constantly making these triangles and running around my tray bed. Well, it occurred in this emergent, very bottom-up fashion. Why are we doing this? These pieces are movable, and why don't we simply organize the tray bed in natural language clusters that actually reflect what we're actually typing? Why don't we put Mao Zedong together? And then we have Mao Zuxi right next to it, Chairman Mao. And then next to Zuxi, we have Zhuyi. And then we have Shehui Zhuyi for socialism. And then we have, you know, and we can build these archipelagos of connected language. And what ends up happening is that they produce the first natural language taxonomy that I've ever seen applied in any sort of technological sense. And it's basically a kind of forerunner of a sense of predictive text. What ends up happening is a threefold increase in the speed of typing in China without the application of electricity, without computation. Try to think, now it's still slower. Everyone always asks, well, isn't it slower than the alphabetic typewriter? Isn't it slower than a Remington? Yes, I'll grant you that. We're not comparing that cross-linguistically. But if you want to, yes, it's slower. But tell me any moment in the history of the mechanical alphabetic typewriter, not pre-electric, in which there was a threefold increase in the speed of typing. It has never happened. In the age of computing, which we'll get to in just one second before I stop, all of these ideas are from the very beginning of Chinese computing in the 50s brought into the system. Predictive text basically enters alphabetic computing in a commercial user-facing sense in the very, very, very late 90s, if at that, 2000s more like it. And now, to get past the Google search bar, really the 2010s, in terms of where if predictive text is showing up in your email or in your text editor or whatever, is a very, very late thing. It is baked into Chinese computing from the 50s onward. But all of this, to the outside world, couldn't mean less, because it doesn't have a keyboard. Okay, now just finally, very quickly, the age of computing. So what we're talking about here are, in essence, multiple sneezes from the same cold. These are not independent events. These are the same embedded structural inequalities that have been there since the 1870s onward, resurfacing, in the same sense that when you cough three times in a row, those are not three different coughs, they're the instantiation of the same, or three different colds, they're the instantiation of the same cough. These are the same kinds of structural issues that keep resurfacing, and they do so in the computer. The story of the universal keyboard is by this point sacrosanct. So we have this question within that reappears within computing, which isn't about typewriting and about how do you fit it on a keyboard. Now the question really becomes, how do you fit it within the context of code? And once again, just like Morse, the decision is made to accommodate that which is part of my linguistic universe, English. So when we make ASCII, when we define the byte, the story resurfaces, or really has never gone away. Every time Chinese enters into computing, it is forcing people to kind of hack, to do workarounds, to go into those parts of graphics processors that are typically reserved for images, but to use them for text. And if you talk to anyone that had worked on 70s, 80s Chinese personal computing, they're always talking about their workarounds and their hacks and so forth. Well, the solution came. The solution came not in the realm of computing. The first machine to ever solve the problem, how do you fit all tens of thousands of characters onto a desktop machine with that all-important keyboard, is actually an experimental mechanical Chinese typewriter that is released in 1947. And it's invented by a very famous Chinese writer and New York Times best-selling author maybe three times, Lin Yutang, who at this point is living in New York. And he dedicates more than 20 years of his life to this puzzle of Chinese typewriting. And he eventually commits his entire family fortune to this experiment. And this is what it looks like. It looks just like the real thing. If you were to sit down to this machine and push a button, nothing would appear on the page. You would hear gears move, but nothing would appear on the page. You push the button again, nothing would appear on the page, and yet something would happen. And after the second depression of a key, in this little part right here, in that magic eye, after the second depression, would appear up to 8 Chinese characters. And then finally, with your third keystroke of one of these keys in the bottom, which are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you would choose which of those 8 characters you want. For anyone here who is a speaker of Chinese national, studies Chinese, you know what this is. This is a shurufa. This is input. This is an input method editor entirely within a mechanical setting. This is a keyboard typewriter that, in the very act of creating a keyboard typewriter, kills the keyboard as we know it and kills typing as we know it. This is not typing. Typing is what you type is what you get. Depression equals impression. This one said, what if we treated the keyboard as basically a control device for a machine that does inscribe, yes, but its primary function is retrieval. This is not a composition inscription machine. This is a retrieval inscription machine. It's going to find stuff. And those first two key depressions are the provision of criteria to the machine to give it instructions as to what characters do I want that fulfill those two criteria I have just given you. And then those 8 candidates appear, and then the user confirms. Criteria, candidacy, confirmation in this recursive process. And this is the birth of an entirely new form of human-machine interaction, and then eventually human-computer interaction, which just goes under the very neutral term of input. The way it works is you take a metal bar that has eight sides, a long metal bar with eight sides, this octagonal metal bar, and on those you have characters. Then you take six of those in a bunch, and you attach them to a kind of spool. So now this octagonal bar rotates, this whole meso spool rotates, and then you take six of those, and you attach it to another spool, and it rotates. And I think I calculated that there, I forget how many axes of rotation it is. But those first two key depressions, what you're hearing is the gears shifting and moving and bringing those things into position. And then the final act of 1 through 8 is simply, I want number 7, I want number 2, and so forth. The long story short, too late for that, is from the advent of computing, this human-machine and now human-computer interaction is there from word go. There will never be, with one exception, a Chinese computer or word processor that does not rely on this process of criteria, candidacy, confirmation in this recursive process. That will be the way in which you relate to it, including all the way up until when Chinese is first loaded onto a personal computer. And the interesting thing about this human-computer interaction is that it produces two transcripts, not just one. The primary transcript, which is what you're actually depressing on the keys, and that primary transcript is ephemeral. It's not supposed to be saved. It's never even supposed to be looked at. It's supposed to exist and then immediately be annihilated through the act of recognition and then be replaced with a secondary transcript, which then gets printed out or sent over email or printed in books. So it's a very different relationship with text.
You know, with all this talk of technology, there's one thing that never gets old. New books! While our booksellers are always happy to share what forthcoming titles they're most looking forward to, we asked a few of our favorite university presses to give us a behind-the-shared PDF look at a few of the books they're publishing in 2018.
My name is Seth Ditchick. I am the editorial director at Yale University Press, and I also work on some of my own books. I came to Yale about a year and a half ago, and before that, I was the economics editor at Princeton for about 11 years. So I wanted to talk about, there's a book that we're bringing out this spring that I think is going to be really interesting and exciting and hopefully should have pretty wide impact. It's a book by Steve Fraser. He's something of a polymath. He's a historian, a journalist, and a writer for The Nation. He was a civil rights activist, and he's probably best known for his most recent book, which was The Age of Acquiescence, and the book that we'll be bringing out with him this spring is called Class Matters, The Strange Career of an American Delusion. And what he's doing in this book is he's making the case that, despite the fact that America from the beginning has seen itself and told itself that it's a place without class, that it's different from Europe, especially the original settlers who were trying to escape a very rigid class-based system. He is making the case pretty convincingly, I think, that class matters and has always mattered in American history. And he does this by telling the story through six signposts in American history. So, and this goes all the way back to the settlements of Plymouth and Jamestown. He brings it through to the ratification of the Constitution, the erection of the Statue of Liberty, to more recent events. So the kitchen debate that happened between Richard Nixon and Khrushchev, and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So, and in each of these cases, he's showing how classes really shaped the national conversation. And what I find really interesting about this book is that in most of these chapters, he starts actually from a personal place. So he talks about his own family history. He talks about his own experience. So in one chapter, for instance, Steve Fraser was part of a group that in the late 60s was framed for trying to blow up the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. And so he talks about essentially having the FBI breaking down his front door and then finding evidence that was planted there. And that becomes then the entry point to a conversation about the Constitution, about the ratification of the Constitution, about Philadelphia as the center of that. It's a personal history. It's a national history. And it's just incredibly compelling.
Hi, this is Tim Minnell from the University of Chicago Press, and I am here to tell you about a book called Is the Cemetery Dead? The answer is maybe. The author of this book is David Sloan, who is a professor at the University of Southern California, and he's known for his first book called The Last Great Necessity, which was a formal history of the cemetery. So what is this book? Well, this book is what he's been thinking over the last 30 years about cemeteries and how his thinking about death has changed. And it's a much more personal book. It's a much more contemporary book. It's a much more observant book about what we actually do today. I think a lot of people know that cremation has become the dominant mode of body disposal in America. But there are a whole range of technologies on the horizon that may change how we deal with bodies. And there's been a huge cultural shift in how we talk about death and how we memorialize people, from tattoos to stickers on cars to graffiti to ghost bikes for bicyclists who have been killed in traffic. And Sloan meditates on all of these in a personal, affecting way. Sloan himself grew up in a cemetery. He comes from a family of mortuary managers, and his family home was on the grounds of the cemetery in Syracuse, New York. While you'd think that would make him attuned his whole life to problems of death and burial, he actually had a big shift a few years ago when his first wife died abruptly in their kitchen, and he grappled for the first time with real grief. This is what set him on the path to this new book, and it's a mesmerizing, affecting, and eye-opening, and even startling look at what we actually talk about when we talk about dead bodies. Boy, there's this whole thing about the mushroom suit. I don't even want to get into it.
In the book, there's a thing about a mushroom
book,
suit?
Yeah, it's like a Tyvek suit that's filled with spores, and the idea is that you put the body in the suit, and the spores go to work, and what you wind up with is some bones and some soil.
Oh, goodness. This is like Tupperware for the body.
Right, exactly. And then, and then you can use the soil to, put it in.
Right, right, of course, in our ecologically minded age.
Yes, right, exactly.
What's the larger idea?
That's very creepy.
Wow. My name is Eric Henney. I'm an acquisitions editor here at Princeton University Press. I focus specifically on physics, astronomy, earth science, and computer information science, but the press writ large covers most major branches of the sciences, humanities, and social sciences. We're a nonprofit independent book publisher right on Princeton's campus, and we've been doing what we do for a bit over a century now. The first book that I actually wanted to talk to you about is one of my books that's coming out in a couple of months, which I'm really excited about. It's called Brave New Arctic by Mark Cerise, who's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center. And this book is about what is arguably one of the most scientific or most important scientific discoveries of the last 20 years, something called Arctic amplification. That's kind of a fancy term for the fact that the Arctic is being affected by climate change more severely than the rest of the planet, basically that it is melting away. There's been a lot of news coverage about this over the last few years. One thing that people don't necessarily understand, though, is that Arctic amplification is probably going to usher in a new planetary regime. And this book is really about this issue of how the changing Arctic is going to change the planet. It's framed, however, by the story of its own discovery. It begins in the mid-90s when researchers noticed that there was weird stuff going on in the Arctic Circle regarding sea ice cover, ocean circulation, permafrost, things like that. And through a largely self-organized process, a group of scientists from around the world banded together to figure out why. They basically spurred an entirely new age of Arctic exploration, and this book takes a kind of chronological approach to that scientific story. It's told from Mark's perspective. He's a working scientist. He's got 30 years of experience researching the Arctic, and about half of which were spent working on what would become, what would turn out to be Arctic amplification. You know, exploring the Arctic is a kind of a cool job, so there are lots of fun stories in here about getting chased by moose around your campsite and stranded in whiteouts and things like that. We do want the book to help show what it is really like to be a field researcher. And it's also worth mentioning, he, like a lot of his peers, looked desperately for reasons to believe that the changes in the Arctic were due to natural climate variability. And so his own reckoning with the changing Arctic is in the book. At the end of the day, however, it is a book about science, and Mark dedicates a lot of time to explaining how the Arctic has worked in the past, how it's working now, and how we think it might work in the future. And really the end of the book, the future part of the book, is where the title takes its cue from, because in the final chapters, the author explores what the kind of brave new world that Arctic amplification will usher in, which will include things like changing weather patterns in the mid-latitudes, possible socio-political squabbles over shipping channels in the Arctic Circle changing, thawing permafrost, and the risk of releasing diseases that have been locked in the ice for hundreds or thousands of years back into the air. Mark is, I think, a really good writer. He's a really good storyteller. But overall, this is a book about real science. And hopefully, what I took away from it when I was reading it, what I hope everyone else takes away when they read it, is not just that the Arctic is warming, but why, and why that matters.
Look forward to Class Matters this March, and Is the Cemetery Dead? And Brave New Arctic this April. Find Programmed Inequality, The Chinese Typewriter, and more than 100,000 other titles on our shelves or online at semcoop.com. And hey, while you're there, make sure you sign up to become a member of the co-op. You'll join a community of readers worldwide, earn credit toward future purchases in-store and online, and receive free weekly updates on events, new releases, this podcast, and more.